This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Night School, the show in which we try to explore ideas. Today, to help us look at the question of Buddhism, is Dr. Tim Rackett. He is with Help University. He's an associate professor there, setting up a Center for Ethics, Development and Globalization Studies. I want to begin with the background story about you yourself. You know, are you a Buddhist, for starters? Are you a Buddhist?
It's a difficult question. I agree with some of the things, but I don't know if I want to say I am a Buddhist. I mean, because the Buddha would probably say, I'm not a Buddhist, just like Marx said, I'm not a Marxist. Right, but perhaps if you're a Buddhist, you would say, I'm a practitioner of the Dharma. Yeah, perhaps.
Okay, so we're going to get to those key concepts later. But Tim, I wanted to ask you about your own intellectual formation. Could you tell us a little bit about where you studied and what drew you to the kind of subjects that you did eventually kind of get some depth into?
After working for a while, after leaving school and working, I went to university as a mature student. I thought it's one of the best places to go to read sociology, which was Essex University. So I'm like an Essex lad. When I was at Essex, I was exposed to like social theory and what's called post-structuralism. I was very lucky as an undergraduate when I was reading sociology. I sat in on an MA course with a very famous, I suppose we could call him a political philosopher, who's dead now, sadly, called Ernesto Laclau. And he really, that's where I learned about structuralism, post-structuralism, about Lacan, Foucault, Derrida, Roland Barthes, and how people were thinking about language and identity, all the kind of interesting intellectual debates. It was very, very stimulating.
I mean, in fact, all those topics, all those themes that you mentioned, we've covered in some way over the last 2 years. I remember that Ernesto Laclau wrote a book with Chantal Mouffe about hegemony and socialist strategy, wasn't it?
Yes,
that's famous
correct.
Book?
Yes, yes.
So, okay, so you studied under the famous Ernesto Laclau. That was amazing. I mean, were lectures riveting and exciting? Did you leave with a buzz?
Yeah, absolutely. He had a very like a charismatic style and stimulating. I mean, it was very different from, you know, sociology can be very turgid and boring and very empiricist. Sociology can just be like studying three variables: race, class, and gender. But this was kind of exciting intellectual ideas and ideas about deconstruction but applying them to important political issues for understanding where we are at the present in British society and in Europe, and making sense of politics and power in a radical new way. You felt like this is really new and exciting. So that was very good, yeah.
But, you know, as an educator, do you think it's important, though, that everybody begins, as it were, at the beginning and learn, you know, even the positivist strain of sociology, you know, learn, I mean, all the traditions of sociology, because it's quite a mix, isn't it? There's such a span. Do you think it's important to start with everything before you start to kind of, you know, make your choices?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, you should, the founding fathers or the mothers or all the important thinkers, it's good to learn them, to be able to appreciate, is anything new? Is somebody, this new theory or some, is it just a trend or a fashion? I mean, one instance in that case, as you probably talked about in your radio show, is about postmodernism. Postmodernism is, I wouldn't say people like Foucault or Derrida are actually postmodernists. Perhaps people like Baudrillard are, but it's, if you understand what is postmodernism saying, it's recycling a lot of relativism, which is really, really problematic, saying what I mean by that. It's like everything is a matter of belief. All beliefs are equally valid and like anything goes. That very highly problematic kind of presupposition. So you need a good foundation. Actually, I think you really need, in social sciences, you need a good philosophical foundation. You know, you need the rigor to kind of how to reason and how to argue.
we started off by saying we were going to talk about Buddhism. Yeah. And I'm thinking of the kind of founding fathers. And I don't have a mother in this list I'm going to mention. They all in some ways spoke about religion. Marx,
yes, yeah.
Weber, Durkheim, yeah. You know, even I think Georg Simmel to some extent. But
yeah.
When you decided that you were going to look at Buddhism in particular, did these founding fathers have anything to say to you of value to understand the phenomena or the tradition of Buddhism?
What led me to kind of Buddhism actually is my study of Foucault and Foucault's later work about the care of the self. I mean, actually, to go back, it's Marcel Mauss and Durkheim looking at techniques of self, how the self is constructed, how we construct our identities. And it's like Foucault's later work on practices of the self. And really, actually, if we go back to the ancient Greeks, how... And just like Wittgenstein said, Ludwig Wittgenstein said that philosophy is an activity. It's a way of life. Now, for the ancient Greeks, and Foucault underscores this very much, philosophy is a way of life. It's a practice. Yeah?
It's not an academic study.
No, absolutely not. No, it's about how you govern yourself, how you govern your heart, mind. Are you, enslaved by your passions? What's the role of reason and intellect? How should you live your life? How should you conduct yourself and your relations with other people? And it was that kind of Foucauldian notion that I thought was very interesting about Buddhism. Buddhism, I would say, what attracted me to it is actually it's not a religion. You say it is a way of life, or properly speaking, it's an ethics, yeah? About how to conduct one's life to cope with existence, really.
So I know Foucault did write quite a bit about ethics. Just to clarify my mind, Foucault was not in the business of prescribing an ethics. He wasn't there to say, well, these are good ethics, these are good ways to live. It wasn't a normative project, right? It was much, much more like an analytical and critical analysis of some discourses.
That's very true. I mean, for Foucault would say, and I think there's a kind of something similar to Buddhism here, would look at a discourse or a practice and say, it's neither true nor is it false. And similarly, Buddhism says a similar thing, yeah? But actually, you can't escape the normative. One can never just describe what is, how you're always going to say, you always get involved in a value judgment of how things ought to be. I mean, facts don't speak for themselves. They can't just say things just are. We're always interpreting, and that's when the value and a judgment comes into play. So when Foucault was studying, why did he choose a particular problem or issue to look at? Because he had a relationship to the present. His whole work is a history of the present. He'd say, what is it to be a human? What does it mean to be human? Who are we? What are we? And what are we becoming?
Isn't it also that with Foucault, it's not described perhaps as the foundations for a morality, but it's a politics. I mean, I think when you interrogate Foucault about his work and you demand from him the import of his work, you know, what does this mean? When you say this about the world, what does it mean for contemporary struggles for labor, for, you know, gays and lesbians, for the nation state? I mean, it is essentially a political question, not a moral one.
Yeah, but I think with him, it's an ethical question as well. It's like how we conduct ourselves. It's a like somewhat similarly to deconstruction. It's a shaking up of things. It's like saying, well, the forms of experiencing ourselves, the kind of identities we live, we feel they're necessary, inevitable. They're natural. They're not. They're highly contingent. But his thought is kind of like shake us out of those. Say there's other ways of being. There's like the simile in anthropology teaches us there's many different and diverse ways to be human, and like how we live with one another, how we care for ourselves. I mean, Foucault's like makes radical suggestions for philosophy, and one of them, put simply, is like not this idea of know thyself, but he says, well, this is marginalized and kind of like obscured the importance of care of the self. Yeah, what is it to care for oneself? And I mean, Foucault intellectually is a modern Nietzschean. I think really, the more I read of Nietzsche, I can see that Foucault, that's where his orientation kind of comes from, though he claims that Heidegger was very important for him as well. But I think this, he is an absolute Nietzschean.
Okay, yeah. Well, Nietzsche is the patron saint of night school. So, you know, I think a lot of people would know that. Now, just to complete the story of your own intellectual trajectory. So you were doing your master's in Essex, and then you went off to do a PhD somewhere else in the same university.
No, I did a BA at Essex, and then I thought, where do I want to go? And I thought to do my PhD, and I thought, well, the theorist who I found most interesting was an Althusserian Marxist. It's somebody who kind of liked Althusser and understood Foucault and would be a very good mentor and a teacher, and that was Paul Hurst at Birkbeck College. So I went straight from doing my BA to doing a PhD. And I read a very good, interesting book called Social Relations and Human Attributes. I think a brilliant primer of sociology, very sophisticated. Wherein lies its sophistication is that it refuses to say, oh, everything's a social construction, which is like social imperialism. It allows for the importance of psyche, the physiological, allows for the complexity of understanding humans in a way that a lot of sociology is very reductionistic. Yeah, very sophisticated book. And because in that book, there was something about culture and madness and relativity. And I thought that was very interesting. I went on to do my PhD about what's called transcultural or intercultural psychiatry, that how Western-trained psychiatrists understand minds from other cultures. How do people go mad in different ways? But I looked at this in colonial, predominantly African, British colonial context, and in modern post-colonial situations of racism. See, this is the Foucault in question. I thought, how is it that psychiatrists have become the truth tellers? This is the kind of Foucault in question about racism. You know, does racism have psychic effects? Can racism, you know, make you crazy?
Where did Buddhism come into this picture?
I think that's a good question. Because I thought Buddhism was, as a kind of, I'd label myself a kind of Nietzschean, also a follower of Freud. So I thought, well, there's no God, there's no soul. So this is what attracted me to Buddhism. I thought, well, it's good, yeah. There's no God, there's no soul. But how do we live our lives? How do we cope with, in our Western culture, the problem of nihilism? Yeah, how do we find meaning and purpose for our suffering? And the Buddhism seems to kind of very much engage and address that in a practical way. It's not a matter of belief in Buddhism, it's a matter of practice.
And where did you go for this? I mean, where did you go to get an understanding of Buddhism as it's practiced and lived?
Right. As I was living in London, I went to a Thai temple in South Wimbledon, quite near where they played tennis. And that's when the monks, mostly from northeast Thailand, were there talking about meditation. So that's when I first kind of got interested in that.
All right. So they were from the Isan region.
That's absolutely
so
right.
So
yes.
Were they Lao or were they Thai?
Exactly. They were, I say, probably ethnically Lao, because Isan is the culture, the language is Lao. But everybody in Thailand is kind of like dominated by the Bangkok culture, which is imposed on ethnic and religious minorities. Yeah,
we're going to come back with more on Buddhism. Buddhism as not just as it's idealized or maybe even framed in the mass media, but also Buddhism as it's lived in your particular experiences of Buddhism and your analysis of contemporary Buddhism in Thailand. You've been listening to Tim Rackett. He is an associate professor at Help University. And I'm Sharad Kutan. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and Night School continues. I'm with Tim Rackett. He is an associate professor at Help University. He's working on something called the Center for Ethics, Development and Globalization Studies, all of the terms of which I think were in some ways or another touched upon in the first part of the show. Now, in the second part, you know, of the show, I really like to first kind of focus on Buddhism, because Buddhism has come into sharp relief, and I think some of the stereotypes of Buddhists have come into sharp relief with the recent politics in Myanmar, in Sri Lanka. But how can we best understand what Buddhism is as a religion, or a non-theistic religion, or a way of life, as you put it? Where would somebody begin to get an understanding of Buddhism, Tim?
In a way, Buddhism is like a diagnosis of human discontent. I mean, there's other people. I find it interesting in relation to what Nietzsche and Freud, people like Marx, have said. But it's like, I suppose, the problem of human suffering. Why do we suffer as humans, that we die from our relations with other human beings? And maybe for Buddhism, really, it sees that the main cause of suffering is the ego, the illusion of the self. This is how I got interested in Buddhism. Just like Foucault, other sociologists, or psychoanalysis, they were not born with a self. The self is created. But Buddhism wants to say, well, this is an illusory self. There's no I. So it challenges, really, Cartesian presuppositions, a lot of Western philosophy. There is no sovereign I, no intentional transcendental ego there. It's an illusion. We experience it as such, but it is not there.
Maybe you can kind of unpack that a little for us. I mean, you know, over the last 2 years, we've talked about Freud quite a bit, and we have a sense of Freud's schema, the ego, the superego, the id. Now, does this match onto a Buddhist notion of what ego is?
It's kind of, I guess, kind of similar. The illusion. I mean, it's the ego persisting, enduring identity is an effect. I mean, for Freud, or Freud reinterpreted by Jacques Lacan, it's really an effect of language. The fact we can have a sense of self is because we have. We have pronouns. We have I, you. I can say I, and you can differentiate between myself and you. Is an effect of language or symbols, as Levi-Strauss said, that the symbol makes man. Yeah,
but you know, that might be trying to problematize what people would think is completely intuitive, not intuitive, you're suggesting is counterintuitive, because people say, well, you know, I go to sleep at night, I'm Sharad, and I tuck myself into bed, I get up, and I'm still Sharad. I mean, I don't have to reconstruct myself every morning, you know, as I brush my teeth. I'm not sort of saying, well, okay, this is Sharad Kutan, he was born 1966, and, you know, I'm not doing that, right? So there is a sense for most people of a continuity of the self.
It is, but I mean, Buddhism, I think, is a bit like Neo in the Matrix, is like saying, wake up, we're in that kind of, we're in the Matrix, or in go back to Plato, we're in the cave. We stepping out of the cave, or like Neo in the Matrix, we wake up, we realize, well, who am I, or what am I? We have identities. Sociology and anthropology teaches us we have these identities pinned on us. Or like in Freud, a very important, take up identity as a man or a woman, as a sexed identity, is very important for who and what we are. But these come from outside us. In Freud, they come from our culture, they come from language, and not intrinsic to us. Yeah.
Now, okay, with Buddhism, in looking at that tradition, correct me if I'm wrong, it comes out of Hinduism, or it comes out of a Hindu worldview.
Yes,
so where does Buddhism fit within the kind of Hindu spectrum of beliefs and philosophies?
I think the most important thing is it's meritocratic. It rejects caste. And the Theravadin Thai Buddhism I like, there's a couple of names here. There's two great masters, teachers. One's called Buddhadasa, and one's Ajahn Chah. Now, these Thai Theravadin Buddhists kind of particularly emphasize how For Buddhism, there's no belief in reincarnation because there's no eternal essence or soul substance to be reincarnated.
Did you just say there's no reincarnation in Buddhism?
Absolutely, there's no self. It's a fundamental, there's no, in Indian Hindu philosophy, the atta, the permanent enduring self, and in Buddhism, it's anatta, selflessness. No self, no ego.
This is blowing me away because there's nothing I associate stronger with Buddhism than reincarnation. The idea that, I mean, one thinks of the Dalai Lama and the reincarnation of that position of that self, right? I mean, how do you square that with what you just said?
That's Tibetan Buddhism. Where Buddhism landed in a particular kind of society or culture, it would take on folk beliefs, other religious beliefs, and they become melded and mixed up with them. So, but in Buddhism, this is the complexity of it. It's like there's no self. There's karma. You generate karma by your thoughts, your desires, intentions, your acts. But when you die, when you cease to exist, maybe your karma would go on, and it might be that might be reborn in some form, but you are not there. Nothing of you, nothing of our experiences, our personal memories, our identity goes on. That ceases to exist.
When you make these assertions, or you're sketching Buddhism, as it were, you're referring to textual evidence of what Buddhism is. Is that where you're going when you're saying these things?
Yeah, this is what the teachings, the interpretations of the Theravadin Buddhism in the Thai tradition.
Okay, so you mentioned Theravada.
Yeah.
I understand that broadly speaking, there are two traditions. There's the Mahayana Buddhist, and then the Theravada, or Hinayana, was the name given to them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the bigger tradition and the smaller tradition. Yeah. I mean, and we can map the world, the Buddhist world, in terms of Theravada and Mahayana traditions, right?
You can, but actually in practice, like they overlap. I mean, at the time of the Buddha, there wasn't this distinction. I think it's important. People try and get back to the core. That I don't know if we can ever do that. But in say what are the essential? What is the heart of the religion? Yeah, and I mean what you've said, just to differentiate between the Theravadin tradition is meant to be more individualistic, whereas the Mahayana, the one, is meant to be is more social and collective.
So we think of Japan as Mahayana, Thailand and Sri Lanka as Theravada, right?
And Burma,
Okay. So we come back. Okay, I'm going to accept that there's no reincarnation in Buddhism, and I'm going to put aside all the things I believed for the last 40 years.
There's no soul. There's no, what is there that comes back? What is there? I think in Chinese Buddhism, that there is a belief. Maybe there's kind of some belief in gods or some like soul substance, but really, strictly speaking, in Buddhism, there isn't, you know?
No, you've been here in Malaysia for some years now, haven't
five
you?
5 years, yeah.
Five, and right, you've observed Malaysian Buddhism, and isn't it a note, not very much? Because it does seem here there is a mix, and what you said earlier about, Buddhism takes on the characteristics of the place it lands. And this is, for me, quite interesting, partly because sometimes people try to explain a religious tradition in terms of text, and there's a level of abstraction. Yeah. And then, of course, there's the really existing religion.
Absolutely. That's what I think we must understand, how it's lived, how it's interpreted, how it's put into practice. I mean, by lay people, not just by the monks and the nuns. Yeah, that's another important thing about gender and sexual difference.
These are the bhikkhu, is it?
Yeah, the bhikkhu, the female nuns as well. Yeah, it's a tradition, yeah.
Okay, so we come to the very interesting question of Buddhism in the contemporary world.
Yes,
Buddhism as it interacts with the nation state.
Yes, perhaps
the question, I mean, if you want to throw out the idea of reincarnation, let me just ask you the question about the idea of Buddhism as a religion of peace. And this is not a claim made only by Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Many religions claim to be the religion of peace and then go on to, slaughter and do all kinds of things, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So where is it Why is it that this religion of peace can also be the religion of the nation state or proto-fascist groups as we have now in Myanmar and such? Well, I mean, what are the textual resources for those groups?
I think it's this is where we have to go to Wittgenstein to understand a belief system or a spiritual practice. We have to understand it, as you correctly said, really how it really exists. And that is why I say Wittgenstein is the meaning comes from its use. How is it used? And to put it simply, like in Burma, to be Burmese is to be Buddhist. In Thailand, to be Thai, a true authentic Thai, is to be Buddhist. That's so there's a combination of ethnicity and religion and nationalism. The three pillars of Thai society, the nation, the monarchy, and religion. And they're fused together. The image of the king is a righteous Devaraja or Dharmaraja. And this is going back to what you were saying earlier. It's like it's a fusion of Hindu, Brahmanistic, and Theravadian traditions together with a modern state.
I mean, in Thailand, we also have the issue of the Sangha, the institutional expression of Buddhism, which perhaps doesn't exist in all countries where Buddhists practice, right?
Yes.
I mean, where did that come from? How did a religion that seemed, in some sense, so individualistic, so much about self, maybe the disappearance of the self, but come to have this institutional dimension?
Because the Buddhism as a religion has never existed outside the state. If you go back in ancient India, the King Asoka and in Sri Lanka, this is an idea of the Devaraja or the Dharmaraja. It's been taken up by the state. And the issue is really, particularly in Thailand, is there's no clear demarcation between church and state. That is probably the fount of the kind of like the problem.
So like in many contexts, religion comes to legitimize power.
It's used. I mean, I don't have a religious theory of religion. I think, like any other belief system, we can never be out. Let's be Nietzschean here. We can never, and Foucauldian, we can never exist outside power relations. There's no freedom from power. Yeah, but that doesn't mean to say, we can differentiate between domination and violence and power. But we never outside of power relations. So religions don't exist in this platonic way outside politics and power. And they inform the mundane. They exist in the mundane world. I think the trouble is Western people have got this fantasy, this platonic notion of I'm in the world but not of it, that somehow if you're a Buddhist, you're detached. And it does have a mental or incites, encourages an attitude of detachment. But even, it says we're still in the here and now. You're in the here and now in specific cultural, social, historical relations,
Where does somebody go to understand what is happening? What are the main conversations going on in Buddhism today? Is Buddhism trying, as in some other religions, trying to grapple with the questions of, imperialism and trade and globalization? I mean, is there a conversation of that sort going on in Buddhism as well?
Yes, I think, what attracted me to the positive aspect of Buddhism is very anti-consumerism, and its logic is very anti-capitalist, because there's no private property. The Buddhists would say to understand human existence, I'm somebody going nowhere. I don't own and control myself. My body doesn't belong to me. My body belongs to nature. So there's no Buddhism says there's no me or mine. To be is not about having and possessing. So very anti this particularly Western individualistic ethic of possessions. Oh, it's me, that's my feeling, my girlfriend, my boyfriend, you know, my car. It really attacks that kind of like the, you know, the foundation of capitalism, particularly neoliberalism, the most virulent form of modern capitalism. You know, market fundamentalism, I think, is a fundamental danger to us all, really.
No, okay. You said that you don't have a religious theory of religion.
Right, now, yes.
Okay, which is an interesting session in itself. How do you approach the study of Buddhism? Do you approach it as a Buddhist? Do you approach it as a sociologist looking at it as a social and political phenomena? How do you approach it?
Yeah, a mixture of sociology, I guess, and like Foucault. We have to see Buddhism is being performed at a particular time and place in a particular situation. So I've studied and I've written about how is Buddhism practiced in the south of Thailand. I've understood experientially. I lived for 14 years in Thailand before coming here. I can see and observe, like anthropologists do, participant observation, see how people practice their Buddhism, you know, giving monks food in the morning, making merit. But the trouble is, I observed what people say and what people do, as we know, very different. And that nominally Thai people are Buddhists, but I'd say very few people actually practice it. You know, for the Buddhist notion, if you have an understanding what is the heart of its beliefs and practices, the temple is in your mind. That is the temple. Your heart, mind is the temple. So you don't need to go to the temple to practice your Buddhism. You practice it. You can practice it when washing up, having a bath, going to the toilet, doing mundane, ordinary things. If you empty your mind of greed, of anger, you try not to give a birth to an I, actually. This is the thing about going back to reincarnation. The Thai Theravadin Buddhist radical reinterpretation of what is Buddhism about is that each breath we take is an I or a self, an ego, can be born or not be born. And the aim is nirvana is not something that happens when you die. It's achievable in the here and now. Nirvana is actually a state of mind. This is the kind of interesting interpretation of Buddhism. Things like you can achieve enlightenment, nirvana, by emptying your mind, by becoming selfless, by kind of being mindful in everyday experiences. You don't have to be a monk or a nun to achieve that mental state.
And yet there are monks and nuns and institutions,
yeah, yes,
and,
yes,
you know, gold leaf, yeah, and yeah, yeah, the joss sticks and all that, right?
So, absolutely, yes.
Okay, so, yeah. I mean, I'm actually interested in the fact that you've located your field in southern Thailand. Is it the deep south? Is it where there's a huge Muslim population?
Yes.
Well, some 5 million Muslims, some Malay-speaking Muslims live there. Is that the interesting mix that you were looking for in your work?
It's a place to see how Thai-ness, in Thai they say Quan Ben Thai, Thai identity, and that is to be Thai, is to be Buddhist, is enforced and imposed upon non-Thai people. They're kind of in the south of Thailand, Ratiwat, Yala, Pattani, as a Malay Muslim majority, and the Buddhist people there are in a minority. But it's very interesting to see how the effects of Buddhism kind of work. Buddhism as power, Buddhism as identity. Now, fundamental thing of Buddhism is about getting rid of yourself, seeing that identity is illusion, but at the same time, how it exists institutionally in Thai society and culture, it is used to assert and promote Thai identity. It's involved in identity politics, and these politics have deadly consequences when people assert their religion over another person's religion. The trouble is for the ethnic politics there, and actually it's racism as well, the ethnic Malay people there are excluded from Thai-ness because of they follow Islam. They're not Buddhist. So this is...
Isn't there a word for it? Kek? Are they called Kek?
Kek. They are indeed. Yeah, which is like, we could translate it or gloss it is like they're dark strangers, people of Asian origin or Arabic origin. And the thing is, they're kind of like Buddhism. Actually, I argue, and I'm working on this, developing, I think Buddhism is involved in its actual practice, how it's lived and actually enacted. It incites a kind of spiritual racism.
Wow, that's an interesting... Is that your own phrase, spiritual racism?
Absolutely. It's a kind of pigmentocracy. There's things like Fanon pointed to. But it's like the Khek. In Thailand, people who have light skin... seen as being purer, more spiritually pure. People with dark skin are seen somehow as impure. So people that have darker skins are looked down on as lesser people. And this is with the Khek. It's like the outside of the skin signifies what is inside them spiritually.
But isn't it also true there's an equivalent term for the Chinese? The Chinese are also somehow outside of Thailand too, right? To some extent, right?
Well, they're not. Actually, I as I've written, and I would argue, if you're Chinese, you can become Thai overnight. I, as a Farang, I'm called a Farang, European, Western person. I can never, ever become Thai. But if you're Chinese, and maybe this has got something to do with the king, who is half Chinese.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese, it's interesting, very different than here in Malaysia. They're totally assimilated to being Thai. Mm.
Right.
Yeah, and they speak Thai. Maybe they don't speak any Chinese language anymore. Yeah.
So okay, we come actually to the end of the show, and there's just so many things swirling around in my head, Tim, at this point in time. But I would perhaps you could recommend something. I'm going to make some recommendations too. But it could be about Buddhism. It could be about Thailand or Buddhism in Thailand as a way of people getting into Buddhism as it really exists.
Yes. I think it's an interesting book that looks at the issue of militants, both Malay Muslim militants and Thai Buddhist militants. It's a book which is, the title is amazing. It's called Buddhist Fury. And okay. It's about how people use Buddhism, how it's used, and it comes an issue of national security, and how it rather kind of provocatively shows how... some soldiers and security forces can kill in the name of protecting the Dharma and Buddhism.
And yeah. Who's the author?
Sorry, it's Michael K. Jerrison. Yeah.
Buddhist Fury. Okay. Yeah. I mean, maybe I could make a quick suggestion of books that have become classics in Thai studies. Tong Chai Winichakul's Mapping Siam, and also Kasian Tejapira's The Commodification of Marxism, I believe is the title of his book. Both, and maybe together with Buddhist Fury, which I think is something I'm going to try and get. Is it a new book?
It's out a few years ago, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for being on the show and sharing your thoughts with us. We actually, invite our listeners to write or tweet us. Are you on Twitter?
Yes.
Are you willing to divulge your handle?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can remember, actually.
Well, anyway, what we'll do is we'll put it on the Facebook page. Are you on Facebook?
Yeah, I have many identities. Okay. I have no fixed identity, multiple identities.
All right, so following your theory. Okay, so what we could do is, if you write to us at BFM Night School, we'll forward your questions or inquiries to Tim, and maybe Tim will, be gracious enough to engage with you on that. I'm available on my Twitter handle at Sharad Kutin. And you can write to us or interact with us on our Facebook page. I was speaking to Tim Rackett. He is an associate professor at Help University. He's setting up the Center for Ethics, Development and Globalization Studies. You've been listening to Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.